The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. No substitutions, not many choices, but super, super cheap. Wendy's, McDonald's, and Burger King are competing for a shrinking number of fast food consumers with deeply discounted menu options, many under a dollar. These gimmicks are designed to get customers in the door who will splash out on some of the higher-priced items that keep these franchises alive. Well, Daniel Klein is contributing writer to Motley Fool, and he questions the strategy and wonders if the big three chains are falling into a discount trap. Daniel Klein, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So how did this race to the bottom start?
Well, it's a relatively new phenomenon. McDonald's, as I'm sure you know, struggled for the last couple of years. Sales were declining. It was losing out to Chipotle and Panera Bread, sort of higher-end players. And it built itself back with breakfast, with new premium sandwiches, with paring down the menu a little bit. And right as that happened, some of its major competitors, Wendy's and Burger King, decided to offer sort of a new take on the value menu. In one case, a 4 for $4, and in the other case, a 4 for $5, where you get a whole bunch of stuff, chicken nuggets, a bacon cheeseburger, fries, a drink, and in one case, a cookie on top of that, for a low price. So McDonald's saw that, panicked a little bit, and now they have the 2 for $2 menu, which is just a few choices, mozzarella sticks, fries, a couple of other things, but it's basically a return to the dollar menu. And the problem with the dollar menu is it's basically a loss leader that doesn't work.
Yeah, how can they do it? Is it all on volume?
Well, it's the joke I always make is it's the old retail axiom of I'm going to sell $20 bills for $19 and make it up on volume. And the answer is it doesn't work. It loses money. Franchisees hate it. The people you attract with these deals, they're not customers that buy, you know, tons of other stuff. The average check is still below $5. So they don't come in and get this 2 for $2 and then also buy a $6 latte or, you know, a big expensive salad. They buy these items and they leave. And when they don't have these deals, they go elsewhere. So as a franchise, you see, oh my God, foot traffic is down. But would you rather have a lot of people buying stuff where you lose money or less people and build from that, but actually make money on the customers? So when I say it's a trap, that's what's happening. They're in a fight for customers that are bad customers. You don't want these people.
You mentioned franchise owners are not loving this. Are they allowed contractually to charge more?
They are, but it becomes a problem. So let's say you own a McDonald's in, I don't know, Manchester, Keene, one of the bigger cities, and you're charging $1.29 for a dollar menu item, or you're charging $2.49 for the McPick 2, but the advertisements, which are running nationally, not just locally, are saying it costs $2. Imagine the headache your counter staff has to deal with. Now, that might work in Alaska or Hawaii or even Manhattan, but it's not going to work in most of the country where they're seeing the commercial at a certain price and you walk into the store and the owner says, you know, the owner who's driving a BMW and, you know, he makes a lot of money, and he says, oh, well, I have to charge more to make money. It doesn't fly.
Well, given these rock-bottom prices, why are McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King struggling against higher-priced options like Subway or Panera or Chipotle? Aren't they carving out their own market?
Well, that's what they're afraid of, because the problem is if you're McDonald's, you can't quickly change your reputation. You know, even if you increase the quality or you run those commercials where they tried to prove that the hamburgers are actually made of beef and the chicken nugget is made of chicken, that reputation's not going to change just because you add a kale salad. It's going to take a really long time to build up, you know, a reputation of quality like Chipotle or Panera have. So really the only thing you have is price. The problem is when you go with price, then you have to be cheap. You know, there have been all these reports that the mozzarella sticks, people are getting them and they're empty because they boil out during the cooking process. Well, that's probably going to happen when you're using a mozzarella stick that you could sell three of them along with a cheeseburger for $2. So they're really working at cross purposes. They're trying to bring in a higher end customer, but they're continuing to offer low end cheap food. And it just doesn't work. You know, you might see a lot more sales, but you're going to see smaller profits.
I guess that's the trap then, Daniel. It's a tough choice for them. They can't say like, oh, we're bumping up our prices.
It's really tempting. When I was in retail, you know, you can bring a lot more people in. This was many years ago. You run a sale on a popular item where you're going to get a lot of people to come and buy it. The question is, will those people come back? Will they pay full price? You know, a better strategy for McDonald's or for any of these chains traditionally has consistently been discounting your top items, but for a limited time. You know, if you bring in a family because Big Macs are 99 cents that day, you know, they might come in just to see what the promotion is the next day. And if they don't like it, well, they're still there. They're going to eat. But if you get people in the habit of, you know, shelling out $4 for a filling meal with five items on it, they're not going to then spend $12 just because you put a fancier kind of cheese on a different burger.
Daniel Klein, he's a contributing writer for Motley Fool. Thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
When it comes to restaurant reviews, the Michelin Guide is the benchmark for fine dining. But when it comes to fast food criticism, YouTube star Damon Patterson is king. His channel has over 500,000 subscribers, and his review of Five Guys has been watched 7 million times. It was even remixed by the Gregory Brothers, the duo behind Auto-Tune the News. Here's just a taste of his work.
Chicken nugget, lightly breaded, soft, not real tender, juicy. A little snick snack bite on that, actually. A little extra chew. Nugget game for BK. I'm going to have to give you all three in the nuggets. I'm not hating the nuggets. Actually, they're decent. I still prefer honey mustard sauce. Y'all know how I get down. Sweet and sour. Nah. I'm not feeling it, though. You better get back in the bag and mind your business. You doing too much. Hold on. Today, BK, your fries are kind of sexy. I don't know if y'all fell back a little bit on the oil. That light fry crispity crisp snick snap. It's dead right with a little bit of that salt game up on there. Not too much salt. It's a little pinch. It was almost like, yo, we just got finished frying these up. We're going to take a pinch of salt. Boom! Do you want to know the difference between a weak burger and a burger that has strength? A weak burger, you could chew and still talk. A burger with strength, you chew, the meat just absorbs all the space and all the air possible, all in your throat, to the point that if you want them to start talking, nothing but is coming out. Word. The Big Mac to me was always that after club, get my hungry on, not middle of the day, get my hungry on. Because even though I had the two patties in there, yo, crazy sesame seeds all over the bun. I hate sesame seeds over the bun. I'm gonna keep that funky with y'all too. Like, I don't get down with a crazy sesame seed bun game. I want to tell you how official Five Guys Burgers and Fries. When I went to my man that was behind the counter, my man was like, hello, sir. How can I help you today? You know what? That's customer service. Hello, sir. How can I help you today? That's what I'm talking about. You know you can help me, player. Give me a double cheeseburger and some of them fries. And I need something to wash that down with, B.
Fast food critic and YouTube star Damon Patterson there. And the little postscript, Patterson retired from his post 2 weeks ago saying, I know many of you are going to be disappointed that I will no longer be doing fast food reviews, but this is a decision for my own health and making different choices going forward. Sounds like there's an opening. Memoirs hurt people. Secrets hurt people. That is among the warnings from Pat Conroy, who lost friends, relatives, a sister, even a marriage because of his writing. Conroy is among 20 memoirists asked why they expose themselves and others in the name of literature. Why do so many writers risk public and professional flogging by making their secrets known? Which secrets should be revealed, and how much is too much? Why We Write About Ourselves is edited by Meredith Marin and features writers like Edwidge Dantecott, Anne Lamott, Cheryl Strayed, and Nick Flynn, all who've dared to take the plunge with a literary memoir. And Meredith Marin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Now, so you refer to memoirs in your introduction as a way to peer into an undraped window. Do you think that's the key to their popularity?
I think the social media world that we live in now is another expression of the same popularity, which is, I think we kind of have trouble living in our culture, and we're looking for ways to do it better.
So we need the examples of other people. But a lot of people criticize, you know, the self-indulgence of writing about a person writing about themselves. Why should we care? But yet we gobble them up.
Yeah, as I say in the introduction to the book, you know, without demand, there would be no supply. And I myself am a devourer of memoir, and I'm also a peeker into windows person. I think it's just human curiosity, and the kind of curiosity that used to be satisfied a long time ago by a much higher level of transparency in lives than we used to have. In other words, living in a small village or living with your extended family, living in a circumstance when people around you knew much more about you and much more truth about you than I think we know about each other today. Even with social media, there's the whole Facebook syndrome of, you know, how jealous can you make everyone else about, you know, your perfect little Facebook life. And memoir, I think, really helps people who are having a similar situation to whatever's being described in the book, or others who just simply want to feel really lucky that they're not.
You speak to many writers, and they give you many reasons why they decide to write about themselves. Pat Conroy, who I mentioned, first wrote novels that exposed corporal punishment, you know, domineering brass at the Citadel, and his own father, a Marine pilot who psychologically and physically, I'd say, terrorizes his son in the book The Great Santini. But he later wrote memoirs. And Conroy defends, in fact, he said he always chooses the writer and their right to hurt people. Whereas others that you speak to, like Anne Lamott or David Schiff, say, no, don't hurt people. Can you expand on their respective rationales for how to treat others in their memoir?
Well, after interviewing these 20 really amazing memoirists, many of whom are literary and or personal friends of personal idols of mine, really, I can sort of divide them into two groups. One is the group that says, I call them the wimps, and I count myself among them, the people who say, I'm going to tell my story, but before I tell it publicly, I'm going to show everything I say about someone else to that person. I'm going to negotiate with them about how I portray them. I'm going to warn them about how they're going to appear in public, etc. And those people will always choose the human over the writing, in the opposite of what Pat Conroy says. And then there are the let them write their own book group. And they are the people who say, if you don't like my version of reality, write your own. Or, as Anne Lamott says, if they didn't want to be written about, they should have behaved better.
Well, and there are choices, of course, of what you include and what you don't include. After speaking to so many, you know, the reasons for choosing to include or not include, where do you come down on that?
Several of the writers in the book, including Danny Shapiro, mentioned that memoir is not a diary. If you were to publish your diary, people might be curious to read it, but they probably wouldn't get much from it. In this case, many of the writers in Why We Write About Ourselves also write fiction, and they have interesting things to say about why and how writing memoir is much more like writing fiction. A memoir is a crafted piece of literature. It is not just a recounting of events. Some people have asked me that what's the difference between autobiography and memoir, and I think that's it. An autobiography is a kind of chronological, factual recounting of a life. And a memoir is a piece of art that is a crafted book with characters who have, you know, flaws and whose lives are explored in much the same way that a novel is, and even has a plot. And it tries to tell a bigger story than that, just the story of a life.
Danny Shapiro also says to you that the idea of the truth is absurd. Now, what does she mean by that, do you think?
She means that she actually tells an interesting story in the book about when her father died and she went to the hospital. immediately after his death. And she wrote that story 10 years ago in her first memoir, Slow Motion, and she went to write it again in a book she's working on now. So she wrote it again, and then she looked back. She took out her book off the shelf and looked at how she'd written it 10 years ago, and she realized that with equal certainty and clarity, she had described the person who told her that her father had just died, first as her uncle and second as her sister. Mm-hmm. And in reading it 10 years later, she thought the emotional truths are exactly the same. The way she recalled her emotions, but almost all of the details were completely different. So the point of that story, I think, is on the one hand, memory is fallible, as she says. And then on the other hand, what's also true is that emotional truths rarely vary.
We're talking about why writers write about themselves. It's a line of inquiry followed by Meredith Marin. She's a writer, a memoirist herself, and she asked several of her colleagues why they decided to take the risk and expose themselves as memoirists. So many people do tell you that they never decided to write a memoir. It just came about that way, which runs counter this idea that they're driven by ego or exhibitionism. What are some of the reasons that they turned the tide and decided to write memoir?
Many of the people, A.M. Holmes comes to mind. She wrote a book called The Mistress's Daughter, and that came about. She's a novelist and short story writer, and not only never thought she would write a memoir, but she actually opposes it as a genre, and she still does. What happened to her was that when she was in her 30s, she found out who her parents were, and that was a new piece of information for her. Her birth mother actually contacted her, and so she went through a whole process that pretty much took her out for 10 years of her life, and when she started dealing with the emotions that came with finding out a lot of truths about her existence, she automatically went to write about it. She's a writer. That's what she does. That's what we do. And she realized as she was writing that she could choose to write a book and put it away, never publish it. She could choose to write it in such a way that no one would be hurt. Or she could just go for it. And she did go for it. And she said it was, she compares it to, somebody said to her, a reviewer, an interviewer said to her, it must have been very cathartic for you to read this book. There's so much raw pain in it. And she said, well, if you consider vomiting cathartic.
Well, you know, there's the vomiting, there's that sort of cry from the heart. But as you said earlier, this isn't a diary. This is managed pain. What did you hear about that sort of discipline of writing memoir?
Cheryl Strayed talked about that. Cheryl Strayed, of course, is the author of Wild and also fiction. She talked about how the book she wrote about taking this long hike after the death of her mother and the dissolution of her marriage was a purging for her, was a healing journey for her. And for her to just do the journey would have been a big, to use a bad pun, a big step for her. But to write about it was really where it became, for her, a piece of processed life experience rather than just a story she would tell when she chose to tell it. And again, in her case, she tells me for the book that she feels there was a lot more to the story that was relevant to a lot of her readers.
That memoir, Wild, you know, affected a lot of people's lives. But is there ever a point in memoir when you, Meredith, you know, you write memoirs, you write fiction as well, is there a point when you've read something in a memoir you think, you've just shared too much? Just too much?
Absolutely not. But that's just me, and that's why I write them, that's why I read them, that's why I wrote this book or put together this book about writing memoir. I'm curious about that all the time. I am the person who, if the curtain is open halfway, I will consider that an invitation to peek all the way in, you know? I'm really curious, and the way that I learn is through people. I love memoir for that reason. And I have read things that I thought were untrue, both factually and also when the memoirist is an unreliable narrator, when he or she is telling a story about herself in such a way that is not borne out by the facts of her life, then I might think, well, you know, you'll write the same memoir 10 years from now and you'll realize what you really, who you really are and what you're saying. But that's as in life, you know, whatever I tell you today about who I am as a human being will, I hope, be different in 5 years if we had the same conversation.
Well, I'm glad we had this conversation today, Meredith. Thank you.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Why We Write About Ourselves is edited by Meredith Marin and features writers like Edwidge Dantacott, Cheryl Strayed, and Nick Flynn, all who've dared to take the plunge with a literary memoir.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Gloria Norris grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire's public housing projects. Jimmy, her abrasive, abusive father, made it clear to his two daughters that he would have preferred a son. Her mother, Shirley, smoked and drank highballs and tried not to make her husband angry. Typical dysfunctional stuff. Until December of 1963, when a brutal double homicide rocked the city of Manchester and the Norris family. In the early morning hours of Friday the 13th, local businessman Hank Piasny stabbed his ex-wife Doris and a companion to death in her home. Gloria was a child at the time, but her father was friends and hunting partners with the accused murderer, and Gloria idolized his daughter Susan, who would later commit a horrific crime of her own. It is little wonder that Gloria Norris went on from this twisted drama to become a screenwriter and independent film producer who's worked with directors Martin Scorsese, Brian De Palma, and Woody Allen, among others. Gloria's new memoir, Cuckoo Land, is part true crime, part coming-of-age story, and many parts crazy town, and is written from the perspective of her 9-year-old self. Gloria Norris joins us now from Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Virginia.
Well, you were just 9 years old when your father's friend, Hank, murdered his ex-wife, Doris, and a man who was with her at the time in 1963. How did you find out?
Well, I found out when I woke up in the morning. It was still kind of dark out, and I heard, you know, someone saying, oh, no, oh, no. And it was my parents who were hearing it on the radio for the first time. And it was, you know, all hell broke loose, chaos in the home. And at first I was afraid that maybe something had happened to Susan, who I idolized, and I, you know, thought it would be terrible if something had happened to her. And then I found out that it was her mother and another man. And yeah, that was the beginning of this whole saga of hearing about the murders and the aftermath of it and what happened to Hank.
So you remember those little details on the radio, but I would just love to hear more about the murder and also get a sense of your voice in this book. So give us first an idea of what actually did happen on this fateful night.
What happened on this fateful night was Doris Piasny, who at this point is divorced from Hank Piasny. She has made the choice that she was going to leave this abusive husband. And she divorced him after many calls to the police that never went anywhere. And she is now a free woman. She's thinking she's going to move out to California. And so she goes out on the town in Manchester to a club. And she meets up with some friends there, and she meets up with this man, John Betley, who was, I guess people said he was a playboy around town. You know, he was single, and he was very dashing. He was a war hero. And she invited him and a couple of other couples back to the house, and they were there having a good time. And the other couples left, and Doris was left alone with John Betley, and little did they know that Hank was lying in wait, and he, you know, came down and murdered them both.
So in the book, you and your dad are sort of talking about what happened. If you could read that bit for us.
Maybe John Betley wasn't looking for trouble that night, but trouble found him anyway. I wondered if he hadn't stood up to Hank, whether he might still be alive. But any guy who had defended his country against an army of bullies sure as hell wasn't going to walk away from just one. One who was shorter than him and who probably seemed like somebody he could take. But unfortunately for John, Hank was good and mad. And from what I could tell, when somebody was good and mad, it made them big and strong. Jimmy thought Hank had every reason to be good and mad. In the old country, if a wife cheated on her husband and ruined his good name, she disappeared, he said to me the night after the murders. She fell off a goddamn cliff or something, and nobody asked any goddamn questions. That's the way it's been for thousands of years. A man's wife embarrasses him, she pays the price. Sayonara, baby. But Doris wasn't Hank's wife anymore, I pointed out, since they had gotten divorced. Don't be an idiot, Jimmy replied. Hank's a goddamn Catholic. Even if he never went to church. To Catholics, divorce is a goddamn sin. Once you marry somebody, even if she's a whore like Doris, you're stuck with her. That stupid church and Hank's old lady drummed that into his squash ever since he was a pipsqueak. So if you ask me, it's their goddamn fault he carved up Doris and her big-shot boyfriend. Maybe they ought to lock up his mother and the goddamn Pope.
Gloria Norris reading from her memoir, Cuckoo Land, and it is just astounding. I mean, this voice of this father talking to you, a nine-year-old kid, remembering a terrible crime and the shockwaves it sent through your community and your family. So why did you make that decision to tell the story from this perspective of this nine-year-old or your childhood self?
It seemed to evolve very naturally to do it that way. At first, I had thought about doing it more journalistically, and I tried that, but I wasn't getting the truth of what I was trying to get at. And obviously, coming from being a screenwriter, I was used to writing dialogue, and that felt natural and more visceral to me. I thought that I would be able to really bring the reader into the story much more effectively that way. And once I made that decision, it was smooth sailing. I just felt very much in the skin of that nine-year-old self.
Well, you definitely bring Jimmy into the story in a very, very clear way. He's telling you his version of things, you know, she deserved this. How many of the real details of that murder were you aware of as a child?
I was aware of lots of the details because, as I said, it was, you know, big news in the house and it was all my father wanted to talk about. And he never censored himself with me the way parents do and should with their kids. You don't say everything to a kid. He was not like that. I was his sidekick. I was treated the same as any guy. And so he told me a lot of the details of the crime. Some of them were rumors at the time. They were quite graphic. They were sexual. And he made no bones about, you know, telling me that.
So what happened to Hank, his friend?
He had a lot of close friends in the community, and he, you know, judges and cops and everybody knew him because they all bought their guns at his store. And he also had some money. He was able to hire an excellent attorney, and they found him, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity. And he spent just a little over 2 years at the state hospital in Concord. And then he was found to be sane again and let out with no probation or anything like that.
I'm speaking with Gloria Norris. She's a screenwriter, independent film producer, and her new memoir is called Cuckoo Land. It's about growing up in the projects in Manchester, New Hampshire, where her family is very close to another family that's deeply affected by a double murder. And actually, another murder. The violence does not end. Now, you idolized Hank's daughter, Susan. How did she cope with the death of her mother?
Well, initially, she had a breakdown. At the time that the murders happened, she was at the absolute pinnacle of her success as a young woman. She was on her way to medical school, very rare for a woman at that time. She was the editor-in-chief of her college newspaper. She had a poem that was going to be published nationally. And when the murders happened, she fell apart. She ended up, in McLean's hospital. She was, devastated by it. But she did manage to, get some treatment, regroup, and go back to school, graduate. She did go to medical school. So she made these efforts to continue on the path that she had been on, but she was not able to sustain it. And so she would get physically ill and have to drop out of school. And she never actually graduated from medical school at University of Vermont. She almost did, but didn't make it.
And there's more of a twist in her story as well that comes up later that I will leave to the reader. But, this is the central murder here, the Piasny murder. 50 years after this crime, people did not want to talk with you about it. Is that true as you were researching it?
Yes, it was very true. I was stonewalled every step of the way, from the criminal justice system to the local librarian. The people who remembered this murder, it was seen as a black spot, I guess, on the city, and people just simply did not want to talk about it. And certainly Susan's relatives did not want to speak about it, and she was very much blackballed from the family. She really had no contact with a single family member right through the end of her life. So it really had strong resonance. It echoed for a long time.
And you were trying to do all of this research while living in California, the place that your father called Cuckoo Land. Tell us a little bit about the title of your book.
Yes, the title comes from the fact that my father thought that everybody who lived in California was, surfing ding-dong, as he would call it. that was one of his many colorful ways of describing California. He thought the people were, they were liberals or they were, lunatics. And I think, he's not the only one that thinks that about the California people. And so, but obviously the irony of the title is that the Cuckoo Land was back in my home. And I have found a lot of people really relate to this title when they see it. Everybody has their own Cuckoo Land, Families all have their craziness, not as extreme perhaps as this, but, everybody knows what Cuckoo Land is.
Well, it is extreme. And it does make sense to me that you might pursue a cinematic career after this childhood with poverty and addiction and violence. In the process of writing this, did your relationship with Jimmy, your time living in the projects, did it take on different meaning for you?
Well, it was a very colorful childhood, Virginia. The dark side of it is very dark, but the book is very funny, too. I mean, he was a very colorful character. And so, I think it was, as you say, a perfect childhood for going into telling stories and making movies. We all love, a true crime story. We love criminals, and he was a criminal. And he also was a big movie lover. So I really believe that I would not have ended up in the film business if Jimmy hadn't been my father, because he loved movies, all kinds of movies, foreign films, took me to Boston to see Charlie Chaplin movies. And so he gave me a really great film education in amongst the, how to, sell a stolen television. I learned some other things.
Well, in addition to these revelations about your dad, I mean, as you're saying, there was so much to him that was just compelling and interesting and charming in its way, but also so hard. And I wonder about your mother. Now, at one point, you write that she wouldn't have left him because she was afraid that he would have killed her. I mean, what a thing to live under. Did writing about this, your childhood, change your vision of your mother at all?
This book is really a love letter to her. She made an incredibly difficult choice. I think she I really and truly believe that had she tried to leave him the way Doris left Hank, that she would have ended up dead. Mm-hmm. He, on many occasions, did really threaten her. When I came home from college, there were bullet holes in the ceiling where he had shot a gun at her. So she did not want me to have to go through what Susan went through of losing a mother and having my life destroyed that way. So she stuck it out. There was no good choice. We like to think there is a good choice, but sometimes there isn't. And for her, the lesser of two evils was to stick it out. And, you know, she did have some fun times, she would say herself. You know, she liked going to the racetrack with him and some other things like that. But on balance, she did live a life of fear. She was in fear a lot of time. And she made that sacrifice to, you know, have me have her to the end of her life. Mm. And so as I dedicate the book to her, she is really a person that I knew, always knew, loved me. And I think that's what really saved me.
Well, Gloria, thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
Thank you very much, Virginia. I've enjoyed this.
Gloria Norris, she's a screenwriter, independent film producer, and now an author of the memoir called Cuckoo Land. And we've got a link to much more in the book. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Personal fundraising sites like Kickstarter and GoFundMe are quickly becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy. Crowdfunding is the new way to fund an art project or a new gadget or even raise funds for families struggling with medical bills. But in a small town in Maine, a personal crowdfunding campaign went very wrong. This story was produced by the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies.
Sarum Grover is getting dinner ready for her husband and two boys. He'll be home soon from football practice.
Lemon chicken.
Yum. There's this like basil chicken recipe that I've been wanting to make for so long.
There's something about Sarum's life that just feels so American.
Yeah.
When she was 20, she married her high school sweetheart. Now they have the kids, a pit bull puppy, and a shiny new car in the driveway. I would say she lives a pretty typical suburban life. There's just one thing missing. She's not actually an American yet.
We jokingly will say, like, oh, Sarum doesn't have her passport. And then someone will say, why? And then I have to go into the whole thing. Like, I don't have it because I'm not a citizen yet.
Sarum and her family came to the U.S. from Cambodia when she was 5 years old. That was 30 years ago, and she's been living legally in the States ever since. But it turns out that getting citizenship is actually kind of expensive. The $595 for the application fee always seemed better spent on kids' football uniforms, ski trips, and a new car. But a few months ago, Sarum's friend had an idea. Why not ask the neighbors for help?
Why is everyone talking about GoFundMe? Because GoFundMe has helped thousands of people raise many millions of dollars online.
I saw this guy online raise all this money for making potato salad.
This is Tanya, the friend who told Sarum about crowdfunding in the first place.
At first, she really didn't want to. She's like, no, I really don't want to ask people for anything. And I really pushed her. I said, you know, people love you. I said, of course people are going to want to do this for you. And I thought it would be this amazing thing.
GoFundMe launched in 2010, and since then, users have raised over $510 million for anything from medical bills to college tuitions. And part of the way to make sure that you meet your goal is to start by sharing your campaign with your own community. For Sarum, that's Windham, a tiny town clustered along a strip of highway in rural Maine. It's the kind of place you might pull off for a pit stop at the Applebee's, where houses are practical, not fancy. Sarum and her husband both really love this place and work hard to stay involved. He volunteers to coach the youth football team, and she helps out as a football mom. But even so, Sarum felt uncertain about asking her community for financial help.
You know, I'm hardworking too. I could earn the money myself instead of asking people.
In the end, though, she figured she'd just put the campaign out there and see what happened. Initially, things were going really well. In just a few days, she'd raised $230, about half of her total goal. But then she started noticing some unsettling comments on a friend's Facebook page. Back in Sarum's kitchen, she reads me the posts. There's this one.
Poor me, poor me, enough. Life is not a free ride. People post how much they want something, then the next day how much they spend.
And this one.
You can't have it both ways. If you want something for free, then stop posting how much you spend.
They went on. 3, 4, 5 posts like these, with other people chiming in below. And for Sarone, that did it.
So I went ahead and just pulled it off, canceled everything, asked to return their money back, and that was that.
Sarone thought taking down the campaign would put a stop to the rumors. But a few weeks ago, her 14-year-old came home from school one day really upset. It turns out another kid had asked him if Sarone had bought their new puppy with money from the campaign. Sarone contacted the kid's mom.
She said that everyone else was saying it. So basically, people were going up to her and asking her if the Grovers had used their fund money to adopt a dog.
When Sarone was telling me this story, I couldn't stop wondering why this happened to her. I mean, just last month in Portland, Oregon, a Hungarian woman named Fanny met her goal of $900 to fund her citizenship application. In Orlando, Florida, Lisette from Cuba surpassed her goal of $680 for hers. So what went wrong? To find out, I talked to Lauren Smiley, a journalist who's covered crowdfunding for San Francisco Magazine.
These crowdfunding asks, they don't happen in a vacuum. What you're talking about there, it seems that this goes into, like, you know, the political views of people in the area, and all that is still present online.
So back to Windham, Maine. Population, just 17,000. And almost 96% of that population is white. Here's Sarone's friend Tanya again, with her take on what happened.
She has the American dream. And she wasn't even born in America. And how does that just settle with some people? It just doesn't. They didn't look at her as a mom not wanting to take that money from her family. They looked at it like she was trying to scam them or get something free from them.
Remember, this is Maine, a state with a deep independent streak in its politics and its mindset. The line between charity and a handout can be blurry. Sarone also thinks this played into it.
I think it's just the money part. I strongly think that people think that I'm looking for a handout, someone to just give me a free ride.
It's really tempting to see crowdfunding as a no-strings-attached solution to our money problems. But everyday tensions like jealousy, politics, financial worries, they also show up in cyberspace. For her part, Sarone says that this whole ordeal has only made her more determined to become a citizen. And she and her husband have a completely non-digital plan to help her get there. Come tax season, they'll use their refunds to pay the fee, assuming they get any. And when Sarone does get her citizenship, the whole small world of Windham, Maine will know she did it without anyone's handout. For Salt Radio, I'm Rhiannon Corby.
Thanks so much for listening today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org and on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, and on Twitter, at Word of Mouth. And you can listen to this show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, spread it around. Rate it on iTunes. As we know, the best ideas tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.